Thurgood Marshall is a well-known name in African American history. His work on the U.S. Supreme Court is widely known, studied, and cited. What is largely forgotten is his overwhelming success as a civil rights attorney. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Katherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Marshall's role is the architect behind the legal strategy that secured African Americans the right to vote, crossed the Jim Crow South, outlawed housing discrimination, and eventually led to the historic desegregation of schools in Brown v. Board of Education, is explored in a new biography. This hour, we'll talk with Will Haygood, author of Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. That conversation is coming up after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Katherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Will Haygood is a journalist and author, probably best known for the New York Times best-selling book, The Butler, A Witness to History, which tells the story of Eugene Allen, an African-American butler in the White House for more than 30 years. But he's also written biographies of some of the most influential and interesting African Americans throughout history. Haygood's latest biography is Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. The book recently won the Scribes Book Award from the American Society of Legal Writers. Haygood is speaking in Des Moines at the Temple for the Performing Arts as part of the Salisbury House History Series on April 21st at 7:30. And he joins me now to tell us more about the book and the man who inspired it. Will Haygood, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I'm going to confess that as I picked up this book, I knew of Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. I had a pretty limited knowledge of his work on the Supreme Court, but I had no idea about the enormous amount of work that he did fighting for equal rights before he was ever even thinking about being appointed to the court. Do you think I'm an exception in that, or do you think I'm the rule when it comes to knowing about Thurgood Marshall's impact on the civil rights movement?
I think you're the rule. Many people don't know what he did in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I think his narrative, his story, had somewhat gotten lost amongst the other titanic figures of the civil rights movement. When you look at Thurgood Marshall's life, he took 33 cases before the United States Supreme Court and won 29 of them. That is an astonishing record.
Yes, it is.
Voting rights cases, housing rights cases, the epic 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, which desegregated the American public school system. He was the go-to lawyer in this country in the mid-20th century. He had no equal.
We don't have enough time to discuss all the cases, as you say, that Marshall argued and won that really laid the groundwork for desegregation. But let's choose just a couple. Would you mind telling us about Smith v. Allwright?
Yes, great case. Blacks in Texas were not allowed to vote in the all-white Democratic primary, and so they sued.
Because if you couldn't vote in a Democratic primary, that was essentially like not being able to vote in the election, right?
Exactly. So they lost that case, and they sued, and they summoned the best civil rights lawyer in the USA at the time. That was Thurgood Marshall, and so he went to Texas and won that case, took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And what was fascinating about that that case is that Thurgood Marshall, his reputation spread so much then that a young politician by the name of Lyndon Johnson had started to hear about Thurgood Marshall then. So that set the seed for their later joining forces together in civil rights. He won at the Supreme Court, which means he won nationally. So blacks all of a sudden had a much better chance to vote in North Carolina, in South Carolina, in Georgia. Still was a long way to go. The there were still death threats against the voters and lynchings against voters that took place. But there were some Southern communities who said to themselves, look, we have to honor the law. So it was a powerful victory.
Now, you alluded to this, but this was a cause and a success that was really a long time in coming. They had sued twice and been successful, and yet weren't able to actually get the law implemented. They sued a third time and they lost. And then finally, Thurgood Marshall was successful at the Supreme Court level. Why was he successful when so many others had failed in arguing this case in a way that really secured that right?
Well, the other steps had always sort of made it personal. Thurgood Marshall's argument was the people of Texas and the Democratic Party officials are breaking the law of the U.S. Constitution. They are not adhering to the U.S. Constitution. Thurgood Marshall carried a miniature copy of the U.S. Constitution around in his vest pocket. And I really think that's what won the day. He would look at those nine justices, and his mindset was take black and white out of it, as odd as that might seem. The authorities in Texas are violating the United States Constitution, of course. And then it rolled back to the people who were being denied the vote who happened to have been black. But Thurgood Marshall's reference, his framework was, you're violating the U.S. Constitution, Your Honor. And he won that way. It really was sophisticated, but very simple also.
Now, of course, the case that really made him a household name, really, at the time was Brown v. Board of Education. But everything had really been leading up to that moment, hadn't it? Tell us about some of the work he did to really document that separate really was not at all equal in the South.
There was a case in Texas where the blacks sued the University of Texas Law School, and Thurgood Marshall fought that case all the way up to the Supreme Court and integrated the University of Texas Law School. Thurgood Marshall's mother had a dream that her son might get into the University of Maryland Law School, but Marshall didn't even apply. He knew that that law school would not accept blacks. But when he finished law school, he convinced a young man by the name of Donald Murray to apply to the University of Maryland School of Law. Mr. Murray said, Mr. Marshall, I don't want to do that. I will get turned down. Thurgood Marshall said, yes, you will, and then I'll sue them. He did. Murray applied. He was denied admission. Thurgood Marshall sued and won. And on the first day of law school classes, Thurgood Marshall escorted Donald Murray into the classroom. That was just another historical moment of Thurgood Marshall's rise. After law school, he went south on a trip with his law school dean, and they wanted to catalog all of the ills of the black schools. The school teachers weren't being paid fairly. The school children had to walk to school when the white kids had nice buses. The white schools were sturdier brick buildings. The schools for the little black kids were shanty wooden structures, almost falling down, rain coming through the roof. Thurgood Marshall saw all of that, and he felt that if black and white kids could go to the same school, then they could play together, that would lessen the harsh rules of you thinking you're better than me because your skin is lighter than mine, because you're white and I'm black, I'm dark. And it took a long time. He merged several states together, Wilmington, Delaware, Washington, D.C., South Carolina, Kansas, and all that was rolled into the epic Brown v. Board of Education case. It was a very important case because it was actually psychologically, it was more impactful than just the school system. Separate but equal sort of had threaded itself through the land so deeply that when the U.S. Supreme Court said this is in violation of the U.S. Constitution, it meant that the entire way this nation had been doing business day to day was wrong. Psychologically, that's what that said in 1954, and it was powerful.
Absolutely. One of the things I thought you did so well in this book was to help us understand the backdrop in each of the locations where these cases were brought. The lynchings in some cases, the racial unrest, the police brutality, the complete lack of justice, really, for Southern blacks. Doing this work was very risky for Marshall, wasn't it?
Yes. A lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it was in the Deep South. Thurgood Marshall, he often traveled alone. The reason he went into some of these towns was simply because something very bad had happened to blacks. They did not have their rights, and so he was always coming into situations that were very volatile. He would have safe houses. He would get to a small southern town, and he would rarely stay in the same house two nights in a row because bad characters wanted to hurt him. And yet, it also was a great moment of uplift when black families heard that the great Thurgood Marshall was in town, was in Charlotte or Atlanta. They would often keep their children out of school to see this lawyer, this black lawyer, fighting for them. There were whole southern communities that had zero black attorneys. So sometimes Marshall would show up and everybody would be extremely curious, blacks and whites. And so he traveled at great risk. Now, there were people, whites and blacks, who wanted to help him and who did help him. There was a man in Florida, Stetson Kennedy, he's no longer with us, but I traveled down to Florida and spent half of a day with him, and he was telling me about Stetson Kennedy wanted to ride Marshall around Florida so that he could meet black people, and Stetson Kennedy felt that one day that they were being followed. So the next day, he told Marshall to lay down in the back of the car on the floorboard because he didn't want people to see Marshall or to shoot Marshall. And so you're a lawyer, and you're trying to take notes, and you're trying to think clearly, ask questions, do your probe, and you have to worry about staying alive. And that's how he lived through much of the 40s and the 50s.
And while his bravery in pursuing these cases was truly incredible, the bravery of the people who lived in these southern states, who organized for the NAACP, who supported Marshall after those cases were won and he left, those were the stories I was incredibly moved by. People like Harry Moore. Can you tell us a little bit about Harry Moore?
Yes, Harry Moore was, that was one of the most moving parts of the book that I worked on. Harry and Harriet Moore lived in a little small town near Milne's, Florida, in the Panhandle, which was a very racist, segregated part of Florida. And they both worked for the NAACP. Harry Moore was actually the first full-time NAACP worker in the state. And they went around the state trying to register blacks to vote. And that was tough work. And in 1955, I think, anyway, Christmas of 1955. I think it was 55. I don't have the book in front of me. Anyway.
I can look if you want me to. I can get to it pretty quick, I think, because that's the section I had marked. So that would have been Christmas Day, 1951, actually.
Okay, 1951. Okay. Harry and Harriet Moore went over to relatives' house to have Christmas Eve dinner. While they were away, three Ku Klux Klansmen slipped under their house, which set up on stilts, down in Florida. It was kind of raised up off the ground. Mm-hmm. And they put several sticks of dynamite under the house. And Harry and Harriet Moore came back home, none the wiser, of course, finished wrapping their gifts, and went to bed. At 2:30 in the morning, the house blew up. Harry Moore died then and there. Harriet Moore was rushed to the hospital. Their daughter, Evangeline Moore, was on a train heading to Florida from the holidays, for the holidays from Washington, D.C. She got off the train, didn't see her mother and father, saw some other relatives there to pick her up and said, "Where's mom and dad?" And they told her that her dad had been killed and that her mother was in really bad shape at the hospital. So they rush her to the hospital, and she's in bad shape. And the doctors tell Evangeline Moore that if her mother can hold on for 7 days, that she'll make it. And she died on the sixth day. And Thurgood Marshall immediately rushed down to Florida. He had stayed with the Moores during his visits to Florida. He was very close to them.
And they'd been doing this civil rights work for decades, right?
Yes, for years. And Marshall was heartbroken. And he wanted to solve the case. He couldn't. But he rushed down to Florida. And so both of these people, NAACP workers, and they were the first NAACP workers in this nation to die in the line of duty. And so it was just horrific. I had a chance to meet Evangeline Moore and talk to her about her family and what happened. And she just passed away like 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
And I know it's just a very heartbreaking story. And nobody ever served any time. There were suspects through the years. There were lengthy probes. The state of Florida tried to find them, but it was just very difficult to sort of put all the pieces of the case together, I guess. And so nobody ever served a single day for the deaths of Harry and Harriet Moore.
So when we talk about Thurgood Marshall and all of the work that he did he see this work as a calling?
Yes. I think Marshall felt that the nation wasn't living up to its ideals, to its goals, to its U.S. constitutional promises. And I sometimes think as he went along winning these cases and doing this and that, I really don't think he stopped to think how successful he was, because there was always another case. There was always something happening in Mississippi or Texas or Georgia or Florida or, you know, northern cities too, Cincinnati and Chicago. I mean, he was always moving, and so I really don't think he was ever settled in his mind that his mission was finished. He lived the kind of life, unlike King, unlike James Meredith or Medgar Evers or Rosa Parks. We really don't pay attention to U.S. Supreme Court cases until it's won and until it's a very big case. So he lost lower court rulings and he had to keep fighting, but no newspaper reporters followed him around and saw him sitting at night studying this law or studying that law or riding some train at 3 a.m. looking at his law books. It was really drudge work. It was a lot of drudgery. It was hard work. But he shaped the nation that we now live in. And so I really think it was very much worth it. It was just very difficult day in and day out.
And he felt very strongly that legal action was really the better course than, say, civil disobedience or peaceful protest, the kind of thing that was advocated by people like the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes, Marshall got in a lot of arguments with King. Marshall had been in southern jails. He knew that dark things could happen to you in those southern jails at night. And he did not approve of school children marching in the movement and being thrown in jail. And so that's where he butted heads with King and others. Marshall really thought the answer was in the law. The law of the land would win out. But of course, now we know, looking back upon history, that we needed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and we needed those marchers.
My guest is journalist and author Will Haygood. We're talking about his latest book, Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Catherine Perkins. We're back with River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Catherine Perkins, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We've been talking with journalist and author Will Haygood about his latest book, Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. He's speaking in Des Moines on April 21st as part of the Salisbury House History Series. So it's with all of these court victories and these decades of work on equal rights that led Thurgood Marshall to room 2228, where the Senate Judiciary Committee met for confirmation hearings. And letters were pouring into the White House on both sides of this nomination. I understand you have one in particular, Will, that you would like to read.
Yes, this letter was written by a lady by the name of Barbara Ross. and it was written on the second day of the hearings. She lived in Texarkana, Arkansas, and these hearings were not on TV, but she heard a snippet of them on her local radio. And she sat down and wrote a letter to her senator, who happened to have been Arkansas Senator John McClellan, who was a segregationist and who did not want Marshall on the Supreme Court. And so her letter was dated July 19, 1967. And it says, "Dear Sir, I am a resident of Arkansas and a law-abiding citizen who believes strongly in God, democracy, the United States Constitution, and justice for all. Recently, I read an article concerning remarks made by you and another senator about Thurgood Marshall to become an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Sir, I am a Negro and an American. I want you to know how I feel about Mr. Marshall's nomination. I'm sure that I can speak for all the Negroes in Arkansas. Mr. Marshall is just as qualified as any likely candidate that you know. It has been made quite clear which side you are on. We all know why you and the other Southern senators don't want him to be on the Supreme Court, and it's not because of the U.S. Constitution. You don't want him because he's black, and that is the only reason. Chances are that the nomination will be turned down, but we hope and pray that you will open up your heart and let all of the hatred out and let Mr. Marshall's record speak for itself. Color doesn't make the person senator. It is character that makes the man. If he doesn't get the nomination, there will be others who will seek after the same opportunity. There will be hundreds, Senator, and you can't fight them all. Somebody will get it. One of these days, the President of the United States will be a Negro. Period. Sincerely yours, Barbara Ross."
Wow, what an incredible letter.
Isn't that something? When I read that, I told my sister in Ohio about the letter, and my sister said, "Will, when the book comes out, you have to track down a member of her family to let them know that that letter is in your book." And I told my sister, I said, "You're absolutely right." And I got on the phone and tracked down the city clerk in Texarkana, Arkansas, and told them that I had just finished this book on Thurgood Marshall, and that I quoted a letter in there from Miss Barbara Ross, and I wanted to know if there was anyone there in town who knew the Ross family. And the city clerk said it didn't ring a bell, but she would check around. And about 4 days later, she called me back and left a message on my phone, and it was a phone number, and she said, "You should call this number." And that's all she said. And I called, and a voice said, "Hello?" And I said, "Oh, hi. My name is Will Haygood. I'm a writer. I've just spent 5 years working on this book about Thurgood Marshall, and I was given this number by the city clerk of Texarkana, and I'm looking for any family members of Miss Barbara Ross, who wrote a letter back in 1967. And the voice on the other end of the line said, "My name is Barbara Ross. I was 19 years old when I wrote that letter. I was in college. I was home for the summer. And I heard on the radio how these Southern senators were really going after Thurgood Marshall. And I said, whoa, hold up. You are the Miss Ross who wrote this letter?" And she said, "Honey, that's what I'm trying to tell you." I was speechless. You know, it was one of those moments that made the five-year journey of doing this book so worth it. We've since stayed in touch.
So let's talk about those hearings that she was writing about and some of those men who were opposed to Thurgood Marshall becoming the first African-American on the U.S. Supreme Court. There were four of them, right? So Senator John McClellan, which you mentioned. There's Senator James Eastland.
Right.
He was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
Sam Ervin.
Right. North Carolina.
And Strom Thurmond.
Yes, South Carolina.
Yeah. So what were their tactics? What were they trying to do or to prove or to say to try to keep Thurgood Marshall's nomination from moving forward?
Really sort of goes back to how you started this program, talking about the legal victories that Thurgood Marshall had won throughout the South. Smith v. Arright, Shelley v. Kramer, Brown v. Board of Education. All of those victories upended the way of life for Southerners. You could say that Thurgood Marshall's legal victories laid the framework for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the 1968 Housing Bill. All of those acts, the framework, the foundation was laid from Thurgood Marshall's victories. So these Southern senators, by the time they got to 1967, and they were sitting before the man who had upended their way of life, this was their enemy, Thurgood Marshall. Lyndon Johnson was hell-bent on integrating the United States Supreme Court and show the world that the nation can live up to its ideals. There was no vacancy, first of all. There was Tom Clark, who was an associate justice on the court. He was from Texas, Lyndon Johnson's Texas. Lyndon Johnson told Tom Clark that he wanted to appoint Tom Clark's son, Ramsey, to a high-level position in the administration, but he had a conflict of interest because his father, Tom Clark, was on the high court. And Lyndon Johnson was a master politician. And he said, Tom, I'm just in the bind. I know you love your boy. He's your only son. And I want to appoint him to this position, but I can't because I'll be attacked. And Tom Clark said, well, Mr. President, that's awful. Is there anything I can do? LBJ, Wiley, Shrewd said, well, I don't know. I do know if you were not on the court, it would be easier for me to take care of your son. And Tom Clark went home and talked to his wife and said, sweetie, I think I'm stepping down off the court. Something has happened, and I think I'm stepping down. And he stepped down off the court, and that was how a vacancy was created in 1967 for Lyndon Johnson to appoint Thurgood Marshall. Lyndon Johnson, unlike today, he did not call a lot of senators, especially the Southern senators. He called them the day of, the morning of, and said, Senator Eastland, I'm appointing Thurgood Marshall to the United States Supreme Court in a matter of hours. Goodbye. Click.
And that was, I thought, really pretty amazing. I had no idea that this is the way that it occurred, that actually Lyndon Johnson had first created the vacancy on the Supreme Court. And then on the day of the announcement, he basically invited Thurgood Marshall to the White House and then took him out to the Rose Garden and announced that he was going to be his nominee for the Supreme Court, right?
Right. It's a done deal. Now, every other nominee's hearing before that time had lasted 6 hours or less.
This one took significantly longer, didn't it?
Yes. Marshall's hearings lasted 5 days, stretched across 13 days. And so, yes, up to that point, his hearings became the longest in history. And the Southerners were hell bent, as I said, on tearing down Marshall's reputation. Ironically, too, I mean, this is so odd. Thurgood Marshall had won 29 out of 33 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they attacked his knowledge of the U.S. Constitution. I mean, you would have thought that was the last arena that they would want to go in with Thurgood Marshall, but they were so vigilant on trying to knock him down that's the arena in which they crawled into, and it was an error on their part because Thurgood Marshall knew the U.S. Constitution front and back.
The other thing that surprised me was just how close this vote was when it came to the full Senate, and LBJ's tactic of calling Southern senators and saying, "If you can't support my nominee, then just don't vote."
Yeah, well. Yes, it's a little more richer than that, even. He would call a Southern senator and he would say, "Hey, Bill, how are you? How's the wife? Well, Bill, look, I know there's a bridge that they're building for you in your hometown, and I'm happy for you. It's a nice thing a man has his name on a bridge. But, Bill, I understand that you don't like Mr. Marshall. He's the best man for the job right now. And, you know, sometimes federal funds dry up, snap of a finger. And I hate to see that bridge drift away from your hometown. I would hate to see that happen. It probably won't happen if you don't show up next week to vote. I'm just putting that out there." I mean, that was Lyndon Johnson.
That's
how he got 20 Southern senators to abdicate on the day of the vote.
So it would be impossible to talk about Marshall and his nomination without also talking about the current situation on the Supreme Court. Do you see parallels between the battle over the nomination of Thurgood Marshall and the battle that's brewing right now over Merrick Garland?
Oh, yes, because, you know, all of the, or for the most part, Southern senators led by, you know, by the Senate leader who's from a Southern state, you know, they have outright said that they won't vote for this nominee, that they won't even hold hearings. I think it's nearly tragic that they won't even hold hearings. At least in 1967, the Southern senators respected the simple process of holding the hearing. People who pay taxes and who are citizens should be treated to hearings. That's what happens in a civil society. I think there are very direct lines. The Southern senators then thought the court, with Thurgood Marshall on it, would become too liberal, was already liberal. And now a lot of the senators are saying that with this nominee that the court would become liberal. But the people have spoken. They elected this president. They elected him, and he has a right to nominate who he wants to nominate, and he did. That's his constitutional duty.
Well, since we were just talking about LBJ and all of his political maneuvering to get Marshall appointed to the court, I was struck by how much political capital he was willing to invest in that nomination. Do you think President Obama has that kind of political capital to leverage to get his appointee hearings or considered by the Judiciary Committee or the Senate?
No. I think that the Republican Senate has moved so far to the right that I don't think that they can see clearly right now. I think that they have been influenced by the Tea Party and by other factions that are just way outside of the mainstream, that I don't know what the White House could do to alter what is happening now. I think it will come back to harm the GOP. And I just think that it's a very unfortunate situation that they won't even have hearings. It's unprecedented.
I was also struck when I was reading about the hearings that a lot of the language that was used by the senators opposing Thurgood Marshall is still used in evaluating justices today. They spoke of needing a strict constructionist on the court. Marshall said he considered the Constitution to be a living document. Clearly, Marshall's interpretation was shaped by the discrimination that he witnessed and experienced and the need to interpret that document in a way that forged a new path towards equality. So, do you think it's possible for any justice to separate the reading of the Constitution from their own experiences? And if you can't separate it, then doesn't that really make hearings about who the person is and what experiences they bring to that role as a Supreme Court justice, rather than an interpretation of the Constitution?
Yes. Well, I think it's better if we have a sense of any nominee's life experiences. I think that shapes the man or woman. I think that informs citizens who this person is. We all have a soul. We all have a heartbeat. We all have a brain. We all have experiences. I kind of think all of the justices on the court now, I think that they went to Ivy League schools. Something's wrong with that picture to me. I mean, why can't we have somebody from just a state public university or a small school in the South or in the West? I mean, there is this elitism that is associated with the court, and I don't think that serves us well either. And I think that, yes, you could say that if you have somebody who interprets the U.S. Constitution as a strict document, okay, you can say that. But in a country that was pretty much founded on slavery and fought a civil war over slavery, there is your explanation of why Abraham Lincoln had to write civil rights amendments and laws and new laws. It's to stretch kindness. It's to stretch humanity. It's to stretch opportunity. And that is what Thurgood Marshall knew that the laws of the land needed. They needed stretching. They needed to be more welcoming. They just did. This is all also somewhat recent history, you know, 1954, 61 years ago. I mean, there are many, 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 many millions of people walking around this country who remember the signs down south, colored only, white only. I mean, this is the nation that we have inherited and that we have to strive to make better every day. And that's what Thurgood Marshall was trying to do. And I think if these senators do not allow a hearing I think it sends a terrible message out there to people. It just does.
Will Haygood, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
It was wonderful. I thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to coming to Iowa.
The book is Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. Will Haygood is speaking in Des Moines at 7:30 on April 21st at the Temple for the Performing Arts. The event is part of the Salisbury House History Series.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth, with production assistance from Dennis Reese. A special thanks to everyone who pledged during our recent silent and not-so-silent pledge drive. Your dollars really do make a difference. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Katherine Perkins. Thanks for joining us.